The Evil Guest by J. Sheridan Le Fanu. Section 1. Quote, "When lust hath conceived, it bringeth forth sin, and sin, when it is finished, bringeth forth death." End quote. About 60 years ago, and somewhat more than 20 miles from the ancient town of Chester, in a southward direction, there stood a large, and even then an old-fashioned mansion-house. It lay in the midst of a demesne of considerable extent, and richly wooded with venerable timber. But apart from the sombre majesty of these giant groups, and the varieties of the undulating ground on which they stood, there was little that could be deemed attractive in the place. A certain air of neglect and decay, and an indescribable gloom and melancholy, hung over it. In darkness, it seemed darker than any other tract. When the moonlight fell upon its glades and hollows, they looked spectral and awful, with a sort of churchyard loneliness, and even when the blush of the morning kissed its broad woodlands, there was a melancholy in the salute that saddened rather than cheered the heart of the beholder. This antique, melancholy, and neglected place we shall call, for distinctness' sake, Grey Forest. It was then the property of the younger son of a nobleman, once celebrated for his ability and his daring, but who had long since passed to that land where human wisdom and courage avail not. The representative of this noble house resided at the family mansion in Sussex, and the cadet, whose fortunes we mean to sketch in these pages, lived upon the narrow margin of an encumbered income, in a reserved and unsocial discontent, deep among the solemn shadows of the old woods of Grey Forest. The Honourable Richard Marston was now somewhere between 40 and 50 years of age, perhaps nearer the latter. He still, however, retained, in an eminent degree, the traits of manly beauty, not the less remarkable for its unquestionably haughty and passionate character. He had married a beautiful girl, of good family, but without much money, somewhere about 18 years before, and two children, a son and a daughter, had been the fruit of this union. The boy, Harry Marston, was at this time at Cambridge, and his sister, scarcely 15, was at home with her parents, and under the training of an accomplished governess, who had been recommended to them by a noble relative of Mrs. Marston. She was a native of France, but thoroughly mistress of the English language, and except for a foreign accent, which gave a certain prettiness to all she said, she spoke it as perfectly as any native Englishwoman. This young Frenchwoman was eminently handsome and attractive. Expressive, dark eyes, a clear olive complexion, small even teeth, and a beautifully dimpling smile, more perhaps than a strictly classic regularity of features, were the secrets of her unquestionable influence at first sight upon the fancy of every man of taste who beheld her. Mr. Marston's fortune, never very large, had been shattered by early dissipation. Naturally of a proud and somewhat exacting temper, he actively felt the mortifying consequences of his poverty. The want of what he felt ought to have been his position and influence in the county in which he resided, fretted and galled him, and he cherished a resentful and bitter sense of every slight, imaginary or real, to which the same fruitful source of annoyance and humiliation had exposed him. He held, therefore, but little intercourse with the surrounding gentry, and that little not of the pleasantest possible kind. For not being himself in a condition to entertain, in that style which accorded with his ideas of his station, he declined, as far as was compatible with good breeding, all the proffered hospitalities of the neighbourhood, and from his wild and neglected park looked out upon the surrounding world in a spirit of moroseness and defiance, very unlike, indeed, to that of neighbourly goodwill. In the midst, however, of many of the annoyances attendant upon crippled means, he enjoyed a few of those shadowy indications of hereditary importance which are all the more dearly prized as the substantial accessories of wealth have disappeared. The mansion in which he dwelt was, though old-fashioned, imposing in its aspect, and upon a scale unequivocally aristocratic. Its walls were hung with ancestral portraits, and he managed to maintain about him a large and tolerably respectable staff of servants. In addition to these, he had his extensive domain, his deer park, and his unrivalled timber wherewith to console himself. And in the consciousness of these possessions, he found some imperfect assuagement of those bitter feelings of suppressed scorn and resentment, which a sense of lost station and slighted importance engendered. Mr. Marston's early habits had, unhappily, been of a kind to aggravate, rather than alleviate, the annoyances incidental to reduced means. He had been a gay man, a voluptuary, and a gambler. His vicious tastes had survived the means of their gratification. His love for his wife had been nothing more than one of those vehement and headstrong fancies which, in self-indulgent men, sometimes result in marriage, and which seldom outlive the first few months of that life.